And he goes charging out of one. He's going to charge across the way to the other dressing room.
Oh, he busts in the other room. He's on Cornette. He's got Cornette in the middle of the floor. Jimmy Garvin on top of Cornette.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 116 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winson. And today, at long last, because I've had this in my queue for probably over a year now, I'll be taking a look at NWA Pro from February 21st, 1987, as Jim Crockett Promotions. The territory is still on fire 3 months after Starrcade 86, so why shouldn't somebody like Jim Cornette be throwing fireballs around? I mean, that is how hot it was there. That they were just throwing scorching heat at everybody. And we're not talking about Dwight Gooden and Roger Clemens of the time.
Baseball, baseball, baseball.
Given Jimmy Cornette's very public political beliefs, he doesn't believe in packing heat, but throwing heat, that is a completely different story. Let me get in my plugs first. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter. That is at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. And you may be listening to this show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. More on Pro Wrestling Only, prowrestling.only.com. And all you can find there a little bit later on in the show. I did something very unusual this past week, and I'm actually not talking about going to Fenway Park and actually kind of rooting for the Red Sox against the Astros in a clash of the Titans this past Sunday, because the Astros had won 10 straight games and Chris Sale is pitching for the Red Sox. He didn't pitch well, but the Red Sox ended up winning 4-3 as I was nominally cheering for them so as to not antagonize my friend or anything like that. The unusual thing that I did was actually last Thursday, on the day of the last show being released, when my wife had been traveling for work the entire week and was going to be away all the way through the weekend. So she had a room down at Mohegan Sun, the Indian casino down in Connecticut. I wouldn't even actually call it an Indian casino because that makes it sound small, as this is a sprawling complex with an arena and a very confusing parking structure where you park in the garage and they actually instruct you to take a picture of the sign that's telling you to take a picture of it so that you don't forget where you parked, which I'm glad that I did, because I parked at something called the Indian Summer Garage Autumn Entrance, which made it very confusing because I went looking for the autumn entrance and then I remembered, oh yeah, I had to take the picture of this on the phone. So I went down to Mohegan Sun last Sunday, and I have to say, one of the things that got me to go was not only to see my wife, of course, I love her and everything like that, but I saw that there was a Judas Priest show at Mohegan Sun Arena, and it was not anything that I was interested in going to. What I was much more interested in is seeing what the crowd is like for a Judas Priest show in the year 2019, and I am here to tell you that there is very little difference between the crowd for Judas Priest in 2019 and the crowd for, let's say, your average Ring of Honor show, just as an example. Almost every single person there was wearing black t-shirts. There weren't as many overweight people at Judas Priest as there are at a wrestling show, but that's probably because a lot of the Judas Priest crowd, when they came out, they hit the bars all around the casino. You could smoke inside there, and they're all putting away nails. So I'm walking around. This is like 2003, me living in Vegas, walking around the MGM Grand just to kill time, and just the air is filled with like this smoky smell. It really took me back and made me feel 24 again. I'm just glad that I didn't start craving a cigarette or whatever, because I've been off that for 3.5 years, and that's now 3 consecutive shows that I've mentioned it. But it was rather, I mean, everybody was wearing a black t-shirt. Even, and I was speaking with a friend who ended up going to a Judas Priest show back in 1988, and she said, were even the gay people at the show wearing black shirts? And I said, yes, indeed. There was not one single color in the rainbow to be found among any of the people there. She also told me that, you know, she was like 16 when she went to Judas Priest in 88, so she took a hairspray bottle, figuring they're not going to confiscate hairspray in the 80s, emptied it out, washed it out, and filled it with vodka. I actually asked, did you make sure to wash it out? And she said, yeah, I'm not a complete idiot here. And they drank it like a normal person. They didn't like spray it into their mouth. Although the visual of that is actually kind of funny. The other thing that I didn't realize until I got down there, which I should have brought a change of clothes with me to work that day, because where I work right now, well, for now anyway, is 45 minutes closer to Mohegan Sun than where my house is. But I had to go home and get clothes and, you know, feed the cat and all that. So I ended up costing myself an hour and a half in the end. But I got down there, and of course, there was a hockey game between the Bruins and the Hurricanes. Game 4, the Bruins had a chance to clinch. And I thought to myself on the way down, isn't it interesting that I am driving to the home of the former Hartford Whalers, who became the Carolina Hurricanes, and the Bruins have a chance to sweep them out of the playoffs and go to the Stanley Cup Final for the first time in 6 years. And I'm still waiting for that series to start, and it will be getting underway on Memorial Day night, which... got to thank the NHL for scheduling it then, because I'll be recording the Place to Be podcast with Scott and JT Rosero the day between Game 1 and 2. So on that Tuesday night, I'm sure my wife will be pissed off that I'll be in the basement recording. Of course, I'll also be recording this show as well. So at the end of the day, I'm pretty pleased with how everything has gone the last week, week and a half, 2 weeks. I've even been able to watch more professional wrestling, not only just in researching for this show, just from a leisure perspective. I did put on Starrcade 86 a couple of days ago, and I've been watching it about a half hour at a time, because either I've never watched that show start to finish, or I just don't remember anything about it. I'm pretty sure that I would have watched it in the first year that I had the network, because I had a lot of time that winter to watch random stuff like that, because we were basically snowed in for the entire winter of 2014-2015. But I don't remember anything about the scaffold match other than, because I haven't gotten to it yet, other than the finish where... Big Bubba forgot to, you know, make the play on the fair catch of Jimmy Cornette coming down. And he is the star of this episode, or at least one of them, because there are a number of actors in this very memorable and very underrated angle from February of 1987. This show was actually taped on Valentine's Day at the Charlotte Coliseum, which is now the Bojangles Center. It's still standing today. It drew 9,000, so apparently not an issue to get your lady friend to come out with you, or, you know, your guy friend, because there's a lot of female fans at JCP shows in this time period. You can just tell from the way they're yelling for not only the Rock and Rolls, but other guys as well, particularly Lex Luger, who we see on this show. This is shortly after he would have come in from Florida, and he is an associate of the Four Horsemen. And it's very interesting to hear from each of those guys, not necessarily Ole, but we hear from Arn, we hear from Tully, we actually hear from Ric Flair a couple of times on this program. But the big angle on this show involves Jim Cornette and Ronnie Garvin, and this goes back a ways into 1986, as Ronnie Garvin actually faced Big Bubba Rogers at Starrcade 86. But Jim Cornette was on a crusade to put Ronnie Garvin out of wrestling. A very simple thing that is kind of lost in today's modern product. You don't really hear, like, why do you hate this guy? I just want to put him out of wrestling. Like, I want to make him do something else. I think he should go work for a hedge fund or something like that. It plain and simple. And it works fine. It doesn't matter what the reasons for it are. He just wants the guy gone. And in this case, Jim Cornette throws a freaking fireball at Ronnie Garvin, which is one thing. And of course, if you've listened to Greetings from Allentown, I'm obsessed with a couple of different kinds of angles. One of them being the haircut angle, and one of them being the fireballs being thrown. Now, if you could somehow mix the two, and I'm pretty sure somebody might speak up and say, oh yeah, there was this angle in somewhere in 1981 where a fireball was thrown and then he shaved the guy's head right afterwards. That would be so awesome, and I would probably have to retire from podcasting because I don't think it would ever be stopped. I would just watch that from now on. I would just do a show on that one thing every single week. But what was very interesting about this angle is the involvement of gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, who is on the heel side of the ledger. So you think, okay, well, he is with Jim Cornette. He has the same last name as Ronnie Garvin, but you don't think of them as being brothers in storyline because they had been kept apart. And that was the beauty of how this all went down, and I'll go into greater detail when I get to that part of the show. Also, we're going to see the interesting team of Ivan Koloff and Dick Murdoch that had just formed previous to this, because Dick Murdoch was mad at Dusty Rhodes, his old tag team partner, and whether it's justified or not, well, he may have a case, but it is rather interesting the way Murdoch approached it, and there was an actual backstory reason for why Dick Murdoch suddenly turned heel and joined up with the Russians. The feature match, which leads to the big angle on this show, is the U.S. Tag Team Champions, Ronnie Garvin and Barry Windham, taking on the Midnight Express. And Barry Windham had just come back to the Crockett territory after several years away, where he had left fairly suddenly for the WWF, a place that he left just as suddenly towards the end of 1985, and kind of did a year of penance in Florida and bouncing around, and eventually finds his way home to JCP, where he's challenging Ric Flair for the world title in the early parts of 1987. And oh yeah, there's a Tim Horner match on this show, but you didn't really care about that, did you? I'm probably just going to talk about something else during that, because you're not tuning into this podcast to hear me talk about Tim Horner, I'm pretty sure. I mean, maybe I could talk about David Isley, but I'd probably just go on a riff about him not being one of the Isley brothers, and then me talking about how I made a New Year's resolution a couple of years ago to listen to more Isley Brothers songs, and how I didn't really end up doing it, but I followed all my other New Year's resolutions. So anyway, I'm getting a little bit off track. But of course, the one thing that's kind of a shadow over JCP is, in watching the opening signature to the top of the show, thank you CM Punk for coining that term for us, or at least bringing it to light, is Magnum TA is still in the intro to the show, which I found interesting in that, doesn't it seem like there's absolutely zero chance that he would ever come back? And he would come back for the Crockett Cup, the emotional finals of the Crockett Cup, where Dusty Rhodes and Nikita Koloff emerged victorious. I was just very struck by that. Like, and I wasn't mad about it, like the way I am George Steele being in the open for 1989 Wrestling Challenge when he's been gone for a year. It's just, it's almost like the kind of keeping the light on for him. But the territory's still going strong in early 87. It's not until the second half of the year, once you get past the War Games, things start to turn a little bit. So with all that in mind, let's get right into the show. And as this is episode number 116, why don't I kick it off in continuation of my sports series, which is nearing its end, a sports moment for the year 2016.
Malone looking for his first hit of the year. He drives one deep left field. Back goes Upton. Back near the wall. It's out of here. Bartolo has done it. The impossible has happened. This is one of the great moments in the history of baseball. Bartolo Colon has gone deep.
According to baseballreference.com, Bartolo Colon is listed as 5'11", 285 pounds, which might be an inch or two too tall and about anywhere from 50 to 100 pounds under what he might actually weigh. That's what I like about baseball. When an absurdly obese guy does something, we get together and celebrate. That is how the fandom works. It's the same deal as 1996 when Cecil Fielder, another guy of great carriage, stole second base in Minnesota early in the season, and it was the first stolen base in his 11-year career. It's also quite hilarious to watch. I watch that on YouTube probably like twice a year. Bartolo home run, probably watch about five times a year because I just can't help myself. So we get a cold open to NWA Pro. We hear the song playing clear as day because this is not the WWE Network. Sharp Dressed Man by ZZ Top, the theme for gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, who comes out to the ring. And maybe I am projecting a bit, but I swear that I hear cheers for Jimmy Garvin, even though he is still a heel at this point in the program. But that might owe a little bit to him having some really cool theme music. Again, maybe I'm imagining it, but I actually went back and watched the two previous weeks of NWA Pro, and I thought I heard cheers for Jimmy Garvin on that as well. After we get the intro theme, our hosts for NWA Pro are Bob Caudle and Johnny Weaver. Now, many episodes ago, when I covered Mid-Atlantic from 1981, you can go back and check that out in the archives. I think it might have actually been episode 81. I was talking about Bob Caudle and how a lot of people view him through the lens of only super shows that you see on the network. And I think that's very unfair because, as I mentioned then, I think week to week, Bob Caudle was a very good host of a weekly wrestling program. It's just that on the super shows, he seems a little too laid back and sleepy. And I don't want to horn in on the lapsed fan jokes about him. Johnny Weaver, on the other hand, I have been party to some of his work, especially on the network. And holy crap. I mean, a more eloquent man has never been seen since Johnny Weaver, or before him, for that matter. And Jimmy Garvin, he's taking on George South in this one, and he is a supreme enhancement talent, but he doesn't even get a chance. He's hit right off the jump, and this one is quickly over with the brainbuster from gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, his finisher at this time. It was also a good move in the Nintendo game Pro Wrestling, for which I played the opening theme. I don't know if you recognized it at the beginning. I've been kind of jumping around between TV shows, video game menu themes, and just random other stuff. Now, South goes down to defeat to that brainbuster, and it couldn't have been any more than 30 seconds. They didn't read off the time or anything like that. But suffice to say, I haven't seen a South that soundly defeated since Appomattox, 1865. And we go right from gorgeous Jimmy to hard-ass Dick. Oh, maybe I shouldn't use that phrase, but maybe Red Dick, since he's with the Russians? I don't know. Dick Murdoch is alongside Ivan Koloff and Vladimir Pietrov. Please pardon my editorial laughter on that one. Murdoch had only taken up with these Russians a little bit shortly before this. In fact, I believe that there was some sort of meeting in Trump Tower between he and Ivan Koloff. Actually, no, that's the wrong thing. But Murdoch, it's very interesting. He's working a Paul Manafort gimmick here, where he's working with the Russians very closely. It seems to have no real shame about it. I mean, there's nothing illegal here. There's nothing wrong with teaming with Ivan Koloff. In fact, if teaming with Ivan Koloff is wrong, I don't want to know what right is. But Vladimir Pietrov, or Petrov, as they called him at alternating times, couldn't really call him Vladimir Petrov. I mean, there's a famous Soviet hockey player who was on the 1980 Olympic team, amongst others, who had the exact same name. So they're calling him Pietrov. I don't think it really matters, but a very interesting time in the career of Dick Murdoch. Could you think of him as a red-blooded American Texas boy who wouldn't join up with these commie bastards? But he was a little PO'd about his old pal Dusty Rhodes dating back, you know, over a decade, tag team partners dating to the early 70s, and Dusty takes up with Nikita Koloff and picks him as his long-term tag team partner when Magnum TA gets hurt. And apparently it took some time for the hurt feelings to come to the surface for Dick Murdoch, who betrays Dusty and Nikita and jumps over to the other side in a recent tag team match. Also, that turn may have been more than a little influenced by the fact that Crusher Khrushchev left Jim Crockett Promotions at the beginning of 1987 for the golden opportunity at the World Wrestling Federation as the second Demolition Smash, since Randy Colley wasn't working out, since the fans were recognizing him. So in comes Dick Murdoch in the role, and let's just hope he's not trying to influence elections in any sort of way. But he is with Bob Cottle, which is kind of like the alternate version of Terry Funk and Lance Russell. It's kind of like more of a down-home version, because Dick Murdoch is giving hell to Bob.
You talk about Nikita Koloff and Dusty Rhodes. Well, Dusty Rhodes better take Nikita Koloff and set him down and talk to him for a long, long time and explain to Nikita what it's like to get into a skirmish, get into a fight with Dick Murdoch. Now, Dusty Rhodes knows Dick Murdoch better than anyone in the world. But on the other hand, Dick Murdoch knows Dusty Rhodes better than anybody else. Now, Dusty, you know back when we were tag team partners in Minneapolis, Japan, Australia, all over the world, or what a person is afraid of. So what makes you think that Nikita Koloff and Dusty Rhodes are going to scare the likes of Dick Murdoch, Ivan Koloff, and Pietrov? Dusty, it's going to be a cold day, baby, before I run from you. And I'll guarantee what you just heard these people chanting, USA, USA. Do you think that's going to make a difference to me? I was in the United States Marine Corps. I did my patriotic duty, and I've had a lot of wars in this ring.
Good. At least he didn't mention anything about him and Ivan Koloff starting up fake Facebook groups in order to, you know, start misinformation campaigns. One thing that I was taken with the promo is hell is bleeped. Wow, talk about strict censors in 87 JCP, especially considering what you're going to see later in the show with a person getting a fireball thrown at their face, but yet we're going to bleep out hell. I mean, that's the only logical thing that he would have said on that. But Murdoch here playing a game of like seven-dimensional chess with Dusty, talking about, I know you better than everybody. Well, I mean, it's some good stuff, and it's kind of funny how we never got like the big blow-off match with Dick Murdoch and Dusty Rhodes. And it kind of had to do, I guess, a little bit with Murdoch being all over the place and just kind of going wherever he felt like. A lot of Japan commitments, that sort of thing. So we go right into the next interview, which is Ric Flair, who's got a few things to say on Dick Murdoch. And I consider those two linked, because Murdoch did Flair a solid back in 85, albeit maybe just kind of incidentally, because it was Murdoch who wanted the title shot against Flair when he came to the Mid-South Territory. This is November of 85. Instead, Ted DiBiase got the shot. So Murdoch injured DiBiase before the match, and Ted fought valiantly against Flair, but wasn't able to capture the title. But Flair kind of makes, you know, the point here that, you know, what's good for Nikita is good for Murdoch. I mean, after all, Nikita left his Uncle Ivan. So if Murdoch, you know, leaving his pal Dusty, it's kind of the same thing, right?
As you might say in the old town tonight, Dick Murdoch, one of the legends in our sport, one of the great pure wrestlers in all the world, has now decided to walk the aisle from the men's side of the Coliseum. In other words, Murdoch has declared war, just like the Horsemen did on Dusty Rhodes and Nikita Koloff and Big Dust, wherever you are. As you listen to the words flow from my mouth, tell me right now, there's not an empty feeling in your gut, knowing that one by one, all the guys that supported you for one reason or another are deserting the camp. You see, brother, the Horsemen have put so much heat and so much notoriety into the total destruction of Dusty Rhodes that even Murdoch couldn't stand anymore. He saw the opportunity, and let's face it, Murdoch should have been your partner, not Nikita.
Flair is probably right. There is an empty feeling in Dusty's gut. I mean, God knows that it's big enough that there's probably somewhere that actually is empty. But the point that he's making is a rather interesting one. It's that because the Four Horsemen targeted Dusty Rhodes, it has put him in such danger that he's become a sort of pariah. Like, well, if I join up with him, then I'll become a target of this dangerous group. So he's kind of saying, oh, Murdoch ended up making the right decision. It's kind of Interesting Psychology by Slick Rick.
So now, it's not just the horseman over here coming at you, Big Dust. It's Murdoch and Ivan and Pietrov. So now, Nikita, you, Dusty Rhodes, Barry Windham, Garvin, Wahoo, the real lonely feeling, isn't it? You're talking about the greatest talent in this sport coming at you from every side. So you see, Tony Schiavone, that's why the horsemen feel so secure in their position in the sport. Because with all that's going on now, who's ever going to be man enough to take one of these from us?
Because it's Ric Flair in 1987, I am legally obligated to play the entire promo because it is the best year of Ric's career from a talking perspective. So think about that. It's kind of like saying, well, what was Babe Ruth's best year for home runs? That's what I'm saying with Flair in 87, with promos on just all manner of people. I mean, he's attacking Brad Armstrong alongside the Four Horsemen a couple of weeks before this. Now, I probably didn't need to sit there at 7:15 in the morning as I'm watching it and yell out, "Yas, Queen!" But I get very excited when I see stuff like that. Especially, Flair was wearing a Lakers jacket. I was very amused by that. You know, a bit of a front runner, but hey, whatever. And Ronnie Garvin later in the year, and then the feud with Jimmy Garvin, which are all directly, well, the Jimmy Garvin part is set up in part by what happens with Jimmy Garvin in his turn later in this show.
Yeah, you're right. Centered in front, scores again. Mika Zibanejad, and the rope is on here in Boston, and they are starting to boo.
Oof, I remember that one. Boston Bruins have to win one game, the last game of the 2016 season, in order to get into the playoffs. They're playing a crappy Ottawa team in the afternoon on a Saturday. So, of course, they lose 6-1. Two of them were empty net goals. Just a very poor performance all around. I may have been one of the people booing. I was very upset about it. The fan appreciation day was very, very awkward. As I recall, when they're giving the jerseys after blowing a playoff spot. A goalie, Tuukka Rask, missed that game because he was sick with some sort of virus that I believe may have had something to do with some bad chicken wings that he had. And if I ever met Tuukka Rask, I would want to talk to him exclusively about chicken wing preparation. It's a subject that I'm very passionate about, that I know a lot about. And I would recommend to him, look, I know you just go to a bar and you order wings, but I think you should maybe consider grilling them at home. In fact, I'll even come over. Maybe you could give me some sort of in-law apartment, and then I'd be creepy, and he would send me on my way. Oh, well. We got Dick Murdoch up next again with Ivan Koloff, accompanied by Vladimir Pietrov, taking on Brody Chase and Randy Mulkey. And Brody Chase, that name kind of sounds like an amalgam of Bruiser Brody and Wrestling at the Chase, and from the St. Louis territory that Brody was very associated with. I have not yet seen the Viceland document, any of the six. I did listen to the two WorldCast podcasts, one of them covering the Gino Hernandez one, and of course the one, the last of the Von Erichs. And Murdoch and Ivan, future U.S. Tag Team Champions, not long from now, they would win those belts in March off Ronnie Garvin and Barry Windham. And Ivan starts and he chucks Mulkey immediately to the floor. There was a fun little story that came up in Jim Crockett Promotions through the middle of 1987, known as Mulkey Mania. Randy Mulkey and his brother Bill would appear on the Saturday TV shows all the time. Not just NWA Pro. They were all over the place, but you'd mostly see them on the TBS tapings. And leading up to the second Crockett Cup, they had been promoting this team, the Gladiators, who were basically the conquistadors of a different color. I think they wore purple, if I remember correctly. It was actually George South and Gary Royal under mass, and they just were promoting this team, and eventually they go up against the Mulkeys on the March 28th, 87 edition of World Championship Wrestling, so the Saturday show. This would have been the day before WrestleMania 3, and the Mulkeys prevailed via a sort of fluke, as one of the Mulkeys was being body slammed back into the ring. The second Mulkey was just kind of, you know, on all fours on the mat and tripped one of the Gladiators and fell over and ended up getting the pinfall that way. And the crowd was going insane for all of this, and that was when Mulkey Mania was born. It lasted several months through the summer. It's not like they were winning any more matches. but it led to a bout, a house show in their native South Carolina against the Midnight Express, and there were promos on TV. So if you watch the Crockett television from the middle of 87, it is a fun little side plot that doesn't exactly harm anything. And, you know, see, that's what making memories is. It's not this artificial stuff. Like, remember the time the Mulkeys won a match? And it's just bound to bring a smile to the face of anybody who was watching Jim Crockett Promotions at the time. Murdoch sends Mulkey into the table like it's some sort of bar fight down in Texas. He actually does it twice. And when Brody Chase comes over, he gives him what for as well, with a chair to the gut. So that just proves that Murdoch can work today's style, where that's what you actually do with a chair. Back inside, Ivan hits the running leg drop. But Mulkey actually fires up very briefly, but it's not to be. We're still several weeks away from that fun story. And a power slam by Murdoch. I'll give that one 7 DiBiases out of 10. It was a very easy-peasy sort of power slam. Ivan comes in off the top with a double axe handle, and he looks particularly vicious, and this is commented on by the commentary team. And they say that it's Dick Murdoch's influence on him is crediting Ivan Koloff with becoming even more vicious. So here's this evil Soviet heel who's been around for 15, 20 years, but it takes Dick Murdoch to bring him to that next level. Murdoch is back in, and he hits a brainbuster. I'm like, really? We're going to have the same finisher on two straight matches? It was slightly different from the Jimmy Garvin one in that he held him up like a delayed vertical suplex and then dumped him on his head. And that is how they pick up the win. The three count for Dick Murdoch and Ivan Koloff. Now, this feud is actually very, very brief for Captain Redneck, who, on a different show that I was watching in the various stuff, to just kind of give myself a little bit of background, Murdoch had a white satin jacket that had the outline of Texas on it, and then kind of like this, I don't know, wreath thing around it, and it said Captain above it, and then it said Redneck over the state of Texas. Now, from a design perspective, and this is something that I had tweeted out, I would have put Captain above and Redneck below. But I guess he wanted to have it over the outline of Texas. I don't know. Different strokes for different folks. Murdoch is actually off to the UWF in the summer of 87 to challenge Dr. Death Steve Williams for his newly won UWF title. This is after Crockett had bought that territory, so everything had kind of been incorporated in, but they were still their own separate show. Plus, he has New Japan commitments. He's there in April. So that's why you don't see Murdoch and Ivan Koloff in the Crockett Cup that year. But in 88, they would actually have a little bit of a reunion, and they would fall in the second round of the tournament to the eventual champions, Sting and Lex Luger. I would be remiss. I know, I keep laughing every time I say the name Vladimir Petrov. I can't help it. It's a tick. I don't know what it is about that guy. Probably because he can't do much in the ring. So afterwards, he just comes in and clotheslines the crap out of Brody Chase. Just for good measure to let him know you're there.
Lex Luger, an associate of the Four Horsemen, because the Four Horsemen are still a very, very elite and tight unit. Ole and Arn Anderson, the greatest tag team. Ric Flair, the greatest world's heavyweight champion. And Tully Blanchard, the greatest world's television champion, along with the $10,000 that I so modestly put on myself every time I get in the ring, saying that no man can beat me in the 25-minute time limit that I allot, or any other time limit that I might allot Tony Schiavone. But the thing that I'm betting on is myself, my ability. You might say it's conceited or anything else, but that is just pure, pure confidence in my own ability, which nobody else in any other line of work can say out there. But you know, talking about Lex Luger, I see he's in the ring along with J.J. Dillon, Tony Schiavone. Why don't we go up there and see what the Lexer can do?
It's interesting how the wrestling members of the Four Horsemen are kind of keeping Lex Luger at arm's length. Just kind of, you're an associate. Let's get the terminology correct. There are a couple of things in that interview that I was taken with. 25-minute time limit. How the hell did you come up with that? What did you? You were just unable to decide between 20 minutes and 30 minutes? Very, very strange. And the TV title eventually became a 15-minute time limit, which I thought was best because it is TV matches, and they have to be shorter, just kind of by nature. And Tully, once again, is holding the belt very nicely, like a scholar holding a book. But the Lexer? What the hell does that mean? I've never heard Lex Luger called the Lexer. Although I guess you really can't call him Sexy Lexi, because that would come off a little bit weird. And we do have Lex Luger up next, taking on Keith Patterson. And it should be clear about one thing, although we are going to hear from Luger in a little bit, that he considered himself a full member of the Horsemen, even though he was never called as such during this time period. Ole is slowly being phased out, Lex is being phased in, and it's slower than I remembered it being, just in thinking about early 87 JCP. I the way I had it in my head was, Ole gets kicked out right at the beginning of the year, right as Luger comes in. I knew that there was like a brief associate period, but I thought it was only like 2 or 3 weeks, but actually it turned out to be a couple of months. Seeing Luger, just, this is another one of those times where I'm going to encourage you to put yourself in the shoes of somebody watching pro wrestling in 1986 and 87. Forget everything that happens after and just think of where a fan would be at that time. The look of Luger evokes Hulk Hogan, but with more hair. Now, the charisma and the connection with the fans, obviously, it wouldn't quite live up. He has a sort of natural prickishness that makes him good as a heel. And even with that, a year from now, in 1988, he's going to have a great babyface run where he challenges Ric Flair for the world title for much of the year. And you could argue maybe he should have gotten a brief run with the belt instead of having him lose every single time via some sort of screwy way, by either making him look stupid or having him bleed a trickle of blood. He's a very odd dude in the history of wrestling. Because Luger is always thought of by the boys as, well, he doesn't care about the business like we do. He's totally in it for the money. To which I would say, well, yeah, you would prefer that he would love what he's doing, but you're all in it for the money. Do you think I work in mutual funds because I enjoy reconciling derivatives reports? I mean, come on. It's the same for any of us. And there's a lot of forearms to the back because Luger admittedly is very green. But he would learn because he would be in there with a guy like Ric Flair. He would just be around. If you're a Four Horsemen member in 1987, you're hanging around with Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, and Ric Flair. Something is bound to rub off via osmosis, even if you're not hanging out at every bar with them. Back elbow, you know, just kind of plain old strikes. A press slam to show off the power. His power slam only gets 3 DiBiases out of 10. We're seeing a lot of repeats on the moves. Who's agenting this show, goddammit? And the torture rack finishes off Keith Patterson, who, I have to admit, looks friggin' tiny. They didn't announce a weight for this guy, but he looks like he's 5'6", 170 pounds. It's like, how did this guy end up on TV? But maybe I just didn't get a good enough look at him. But some good stuff from Lex Luger. Let him grow into this role, and then when he's ready, you phase out Ole, and everything is good. Even though you listen to Ric Flair talk, God bless him, by the way. I'm glad that he seems to be on the mend. But every time he talks about Lex Luger, Flair always seems to have it out for him. And I don't know what that is all about. It goes back to that Ric Flair Woo Nation podcast where he had Luger on. It was basically like, Lex, you didn't sell out anything. It's really kind of hilarious. I don't know if that's even still available. It's probably on YouTube somewhere. But I definitely urge you, if you didn't listen to it, check it out. It was a startling lack of respect for Lex and the accomplishments in his career, especially considering the guy's in a wheelchair. I mean, maybe be nice to him. I know that there was a lot of stuff with him and Elizabeth that went on later. But, I don't really feel like talking about that right now because I feel like he's kind of an underrated guy, at least at times. He's sort of like a baseball player that would have an all-star season and then he would have like a down year. Think of his WWF run as those down years, and then he has the big comeback in 1997 later on. So all I'm asking is to give Lex Luger some of your respect, because when he was booked at least decently, he was really, really good. And if you want to talk more about Lex Luger, check out ProWrestlingOnly.com. Explore other podcasts, match reviews, features, and retrospectives, such as Walking in Memphis series discussing the Memphis territory in the late 70s. Reviews of wrestling books, video games, matches, playlists, wrestler appearances, non-wrestling TV shows, movies, and more. Join the conversation by signing up at the Pro Wrestling Only forums, online for over a decade with over 2,000 registered members and a hell of a lot of threads. The message board is a vibrant community, whether you want to talk about a specific match in the match discussion archive, take a deep dive in the microscope forum, or discuss more general topics from wrestling's past and present, like Lex Luger's booking. I'm sure that there are many opinions about that, very strong ones, but check all of that out and more at ProWrestlingOnly.com.
3-2 delivery by Osuna. In the air to right field, got it over his head, way back in the wall. For the first time in this game, have a 3-2 lead.
Oh, my goodness.
I loved Hyunsoo Kim on the 2016 Orioles, coming over from Korea where he was a big star, and they would play this song when he would hit a home run over there. Because Korean baseball is something to behold. The fans are into it and they sing songs. And that home run, I remember being particularly unique, not because it ended up winning a game that they needed to make the playoffs and get into that wild card game against Toronto that I'm gritting my teeth like a Sid Vicious promo just in kind of thinking about. But that home run was so unique because of the stats that they keep nowadays with launch angle and exit velocity. The homer, this is courtesy MLB.com, the homer hit off Toronto closer and reprehensible human being Roberto Osuna, I added in that editorial part, was Kim's sixth of the season, relatively unlikely, leaving the park with an exit velocity of 92.9 miles an hour and a 25-degree launch angle, according to StatCast. On 91 previous batted balls with similar traits this season, batters hit 103 with zero home runs. So, yeah, extremely unlikely for that to go out. But Kim was a very good pinch hitter, lasted 2 years in the bigs, was traded to the Phillies for Jeremy Hellickson the next year, and I certainly miss him. Now it is local promo time with Tony Schiavone, and in watching some of the shows that aired after this one, chronologically, it was very strange hearing the Four Horsemen there talking about coming to the Boston Garden, as they did a show there on April 4th that actually drew 11,000. The following year, when they turned up at the Garden in April of 88, they only drew 5,000 for that one. So that kind of tells you the direction that the promotion was going in. I was listening to an episode of Between the Sheets, an older one. I don't remember what year, but they made the point about local promos going away at a certain point in time that would have been after this, probably during 1988, and losing that local touch harmed live event attendance. And it's something that, yeah, I listened to the BTS when it originally aired, but it's something that's a point that should be stressed a little bit more. Because here they're talking about Fayetteville, North Carolina. They're coming there on February 13th, so only 2 days after this would air. JCP ran two house shows on that night. In addition to Fayetteville, they were also in Greenville, South Carolina. There was nobody who was on both of them, so there was a definite A and B team, and it was the A team in Fayetteville because you had all of the Horsemen. You had Koloff and Murdoch and Luger and Jimmy Garvin and the main event of Ric Flair versus Barry Windham. But they are advertising Lex Luger taking on Tim Horner in Greenville, or excuse me, in Fayetteville. But Tim Horner would not make the event. Instead, Lex would be facing Ricky Lee Jones, the brother of Tommy, I can only presume. No, actually, it's really the brother, oddly enough, of Robert Gibson. So Lex, he's not really a horseman, but he's deluded himself into thinking that he is.
Get ready, Fayetteville. You know, there's been a lot of things, good things happening since I've become a horseman. There's one problem that's brought to my attention. I've got thank you cards from TV repairmen and eye doctors all over the country. Because you see, when people see me on TV, they cannot believe they're adjusting the knobs and wondering what's wrong with their TV. Or maybe their eyes are seeing. But what you see before you is real. In Fayetteville, get ready, because you've never seen anything. The physiological wonderment of Lex Luger, he's coming your way.
Jeez, what a narcissist that guy is. Or is it Narcissus? Anyway, we'll just, you know, we'll file that away for later. And what a great promo that is from Luger, though. TV repairmen are thank you notes. Love the image that he created in my head. And it's probably for the best that Lex got to go first, because it would have been very difficult for him to follow Ric Flair, who talks about coming to Fayetteville. And this is kind of strange, because he kind of puts down the town at the same time as saying that he's going to go after some women.
Fayetteville going to be hot. Lexter Luger is going to be a top.
Wait a second, hold up here. Lexter Luger? Was there like some sort of contest amongst the horsemen to come up with the funniest name for Lex Luger? What the hell's going on here?
The newest horse. And Barry Windham, I assure you of one thing. Lex Luger's not coming to Fayetteville to see Ric Flair, the world champion, do anything else less than shine. You see, Fayetteville's really my kind of town once in a while. I like the women down there because, let's face it, the women in Fayetteville stay starved for the sight of a real man. And after I get through with Windham, Lexter, myself, Tully Blanchard, and Arn Anderson are going to terrorize between 15 and 20 of Fayetteville's finest. But Barry Windham, it's no secret, buddy, why you're back. You left where you were at and came back to the big time because you want this. Well, you got it, my friend. You got a shot at history. All you got to do is beat Slick Rick, the world champion. And in Fayetteville, buddy, it can't be done. Woo!
I know that Fayetteville, North Carolina is a military town, but the husbands are not necessarily being stationed overseas in the mid-80s, so it's going to be a little bit harder of a time for him to kind of make headway, at least with that segment of the population. Him and Barry Windham, though, I mean, that is a matchup for 1987 because of how good Barry Windham had become. And I don't know if I've ever actually seen the Crockett Cup match from 87, but dating to early 86, they faced off at the Battle of the Belts 2, which was down in Florida when Windham was doing his pennants. And I'd have to say that I think Windham's performance in that match, which I have seen, is maybe an indicator that, hey, just because he took off on us in the middle of the night, was a little flaky, and actually, truthfully, would turn out to be flaky later on, doesn't mean we shouldn't bring him in at some point, and we get the Barry Windham run of 87 and 88. 87, where he's facing off against Flair, and the Horseman eventually ends up with the Western States Heritage title, the most prestigious belt in all the sport at that time, for the very brief period that existed, and yet another belt that Larry Zbyszko killed. And 88, he joins the Horsemen, has the run with the U.S. title there. Oh, what? Were you expecting 2006 WWE action leading up to WrestleMania 22? No. Big Time by Peter Gabriel was number 13 on the American Top 40 on this date in 1987 when this episode aired. And a guy who thought he was big time is up next. Tim Horner, taking on David Isley. And you know, actually, I'd rather talk about Tim Horton. Actually, more specifically, just more generally, I want to talk about Canada rather than a Tim Horner match. Because during the week before that this aired, in the middle of February of 87, Jim Crockett Promotions actually went back to Canada for several shows, going head-to-head with the WWF in Toronto on February 15th, where Crockett actually was a part of two shows that day. The first one, a matinee in Hamilton at the Cops Coliseum, drawing 3,000. Mosca Mania 2, which was a card thrown by Angelo Mosca, one of my heroes of pro wrestling announcing. And later that night, the venue is not listed on the history of WWE.com, but it was definitely not Maple Leaf Gardens, because that is where the WWF was. The main event for that was Ric Flair versus Nikita Koloff. And far more interesting than the battle between these two promotions, because WWF drew 17,000 to the Gardens, Savage versus Ricky Steamboat, and Roddy Piper's farewell match in Canada for that run, because don't forget, he's retiring at WrestleMania 3, and he was taking on Adrian Adonis in that one. WWF was actually in Calgary the night before, so making the long trip over to Toronto the next day. So JCP has the night show in Toronto, and what's much more interesting is that the Four Horsemen were cheered as babyfaces, which might not be a surprise. In fact, you can hear cheers for them anytime they're even in North Carolina. But the fact that Dusty Rhodes, in his match, actually played the heel and went along with it instead of kind of throwing those one of those dusty temper tantrums that he would at Techwood Studios whenever somebody would call him out from the audience. It's a shame that that show is not on tape. I did a brief search for it because that would actually be really fun to see. And especially considering that Dusty Rhodes, I brought this up when I covered JCP 88, if he had turned heel that year, that really would have changed the calculus of the promotion because it would have made things a lot more fresh. Crockett also went to Brantford, Ontario on the 16th and Peterborough on the 17th. That's 2 weeks in a row with Peterborough, Ontario references by me. And he's talking about hanging out with the guys in the smoker's pit and who were from Peterborough up in Toronto. Why would JCP go up there? Well, they had the history before WWF kind of took over Maple Leaf in the middle of 84. Ric Flair was a known commodity up there, amongst others. I'm not sure what the TV situation was at that time, but don't forget, the WWF stopped filming their shows in Canada the year before this. So it might have been, with JCP at least trying to take a shot at it again, maybe at least trying to establish a foothold in that market. Obviously, it did not appear to be all that successful. Unfortunately, I'm running out of material to stop talking about this Tim Horner match. Maybe I should go grab myself a cup of coffee so that I can stay awake for this one. Horner is a guy who, he seems to be notorious for a very elevated opinion of himself. I've mentioned that with Jeff Jarrett in the past, but at least Jarrett can point to the fact that he's always able to weasel his way into stuff. I wonder, if you do a search, Jim Cornette, Tim Horner, does he actually have an opinion on him? Well, of course he does. He said some bad things about Tim Horner and some of the foibles of his personality, which made me hope for a WWE Network table for three that is held at a Dairy Queen with Jim Cornette, Tim Horner, and Vince Russo. That would be fabulous. To bring it back to this match, the commentary at the beginning from Caudle and Johnny Weaver is actually rather interesting because even they would rather talk about what may potentially happen in this match rather than talk about what's actually going on.
Two fine young wrestlers here, Johnny Weaver. What kind of a match do you look for with these two?
A lot of quickness, a lot of speed in this match. I expect a fast tempo to be set by Tim Horner. They call him White Lightning because of his speed. And we'll see here. We're going to have fast action already. Hard tackle by Horner. Down goes David Eisley.
I think we're going to see a lot of good scientific wrestling also, Johnny.
They certainly will. They're both wrestlers with a lot of good basics. And boy,
pardon me, Bob and Johnny, but what I think we're going to see here is a bunch of uninspired mat work, such as a headlock takeover sequence done both ways by both guys. Oh, it's just wonderful. It's great, grand. Drop toe hold by Horner, and then back to the headlock takeover. And as I'm sitting here, losing the will to live, I'm just wondering, is this going anywhere? You could actually hear a person yell boring in the little clip of commentary they play. There's a kid who yells out boring. I mean, this is 1987. We're now in the year after the big boring chant year. But we get a snap vertical suplex by Tim Horner, so that actually kind of wakes me up a little bit. And an Irish whip leads to him running Isley into the ropes for the O'Connor roll into a bridge pinning combination. And that is how Tim Horner picks up the victory here. And it's funny that I consider him so boring because he is literally using the Bob Backlund move from the signature at the Open of Championship Wrestling from like 1982, the point where everybody had started to become sick of Bob. I'm just saying, it's fitting because Backlund was accused of being boring when, yeah, some of his promos might have been a little bit uninspired, but if you watch more of him, you start to appreciate what he was trying to do. But Tim Horner actually is boring. And hey, I got his name right that time. Now, wait a second here. Hold up. I've made it a running joke for a long time here on Greetings from Allentown, where I will just play Nikita Koloff promos backwards because they actually sound exactly the same. I'm not looking for any hidden message like Paul is dead or I am the walrus or any of that, you know, or the Ozzy Osbourne satanic stuff. I'm not expecting that. I'm just saying that if you play Nikita Koloff backwards, it often sounds the same as forth. But I swear to sweet Jesus, this is actually a very good, coherent, fired-up promo from Nikita Koloff.
Then you know, for 2 years, I had to hear Ivan Koloff say, Nikita, we hate America. We hate American people. America stinks. Well, you're wrong, Ivan Koloff. America is great. I love all the freedom, Ivan Koloff. I love the freedom. Now you say, well, Nikita, now you are American. Well, Dick Murdoch, now you, Paruski, you are Russian, Dick Murdoch.
I wonder, is it entirely possible that the Make America Great Again slogan is actually referring to a time when Nikita Koloff was a good, coherent promo, this one moment in February of 1987? Well, I think it's a little bit more complicated than that, but he is alongside Big Dust, because we got the superpowers in for the promo, and I should point out that not only did Dick Murdoch betray his old tag team partner, Dusty Rhodes, but he also, in a separate match, apparently turned on Baron Von Raschke, but who really gives a rat's ass about that? So that's why they had to do the turn again. It's like when the Road Warriors turned on Sting, and then Dusty was like, nah, we got to turn up the juice. He's got to turn on me, or they got to turn on me. So they do that, that's the year after this. But once again, this is Dusty in good form letting Dick Murdoch know, and Murdoch was kind of a guy known for maybe taking it easy in the ring, maybe not giving his all, kind of a mercurial type, kind of like Manny Ramirez in that, yeah, when he was on, he was a really great professional wrestler, but sometimes he really didn't care. And Dusty Rhodes lets his old tag team partner that he's accomplished a hell of a lot more since their beginnings of teaming together.
One thing you said is true. I know you better than anybody in the world. In 1974, you chose what path you wanted to go down. And from that day on, I went to 3 world's heavyweight titles. While you were laid up in Japan, I've been through two of your ugly wives with you, baby. I've been through more with you than any man. And now you come out and show the true colors. Nikita Koloff, I am proud to say, is my friend. I am proud to say he is Magnum T.A.'s friend. So you etch it in stone, bury it on your ranch somewhere, and you tell your old ladies and everybody in Amarillo what kind of a low-life, yellow, egg-sucking dog coward you really are.
Look, I haven't watched all the wrestling in the world, but what I do know is that the term egg-sucking dog is literally the worst thing you can call a Texan. I mean, I've watched enough Terry Funk stuff to know that.
Even though they've turned a lot of double plays.
Oh, there's a drive to deep left field, and the ball game is over.
I have long feared that my sins would return to visit me.
Hey, is that Mel Gibson at the beginning of The Patriot, or is it Buck Showalter after losing yet another winner-take-all game because he mismanaged his bullpen, just like with the 95 Yankees, just like here with the 2016 Orioles? And I'm one of the few people who says he actually managed a good game until he didn't manage a good game. I went back and actually subjected myself to the highlights of this, and it was a very good game with a lot of great defensive plays, many of them by the Orioles turning double plays when the Blue Jays would put men on base because the Orioles were sure as hell weren't putting anybody on base. I don't even think they had a hit past the fourth inning. And the way I had it in my head was, oh, clearly they're saving Britain for a certain point, which was when Donaldson, Josh Donaldson, a former MVP, comes up. He's the number two hitter. They're going to have Britton pitch to the tough part of the lineup, and he's going to go one turn around the order, and then he's going to face Donaldson again, and then Encarnacion and Jose Bautista. So he's not going to say you're going to pitch this many innings. You're going to say you're going to face 12 batters, and you're going to maximize him the best way possible. He gave up 4 earned runs, Zach Britton did, the entire season, and he never got into the game. Instead, they get to the 11th inning, and Brian Dennsing comes into the game. I'm like, oh, that's weird. But then I thought, okay, Donaldson's up next. Clearly, Britton will come in and face the good hitters. Nope, Ubaldo Jimenez, who, nice guy and all, but not a good pitcher and certainly not equipped to come out of the bullpen as a reliever extraordinaire like Zach Britton would be. By the way, I think it's a little weird that Zach Britton changed his name from Z-A-C-H to Z-A-C-K. It was like some birth certificate blooper that they found. Anyway, it just drives me a little bit up a wall, I must say. 5 pitches Jimenez threw. 5. Single, home run on the first pitch by Encarnacion. Oh, I don't really want to talk about it anymore. Why don't I talk about something a little bit better? And that would be the Midnight Express of Bobby Eaton and Dennis Condrey taking on the United States Tag Team Champions Ronnie Garvin and Barry Windham. But before we get to this feature bout, we got to hear something of a preview from Johnny Weaver, a man who makes Jay Saldi of World Class Championship Wrestling 1982 fame sound like Abraham Lincoln by comparison.
Not only asking for it, you're right, he's been wanting it very badly, and he's been very outspoken about it. He's even taken matters in his own hands on a few occasions to really put Ronnie Garvin in a precarious situation. Of course, he was, I think, a little upset and a little surprised by Miss Alana Lively. We're anticipably awaiting the arrival of Barnett right now, but I'm sure he's got his boys ready.
He is eloquent, and he is thoughtful.
There's actually probably a decent chance that if I watched enough of these shows, I would probably be co-opted by Johnny Weaver and just how awkward he is, and then I would eventually grow to love him. Garvin and Windham are already in the ring because they don't have theme music, because Windham can't use Born in the USA anymore. They're not the U.S. Express. Besides, Garvin was born in, or he's from Quebec, so he can't really use that, even though we're pretending he's from the American South for some reason. And another constitutional obligation that I have, just like playing the Ric Flair promo in its entirety from 1987, have to play Jim Cornette doing his own introduction of the Midnight Express.
Ladies and gentlemen, the greatest tag team in professional wrestling and the new United States champions, Lover Boy Dennis and Beautiful Bobby, the Midnight Express!
The Midnight Express is accompanied by their manager and advisor, Jim Cornette.
So Cornette does the intro for his team, and then Tom Miller, the ring announcer, will do the intro for Cornette. So who's there to do the intro for Tom Miller? Maybe he should have said, and my name is Tom Miller. It's just a Joe McHugh tribute once again. We are actually nearing the end for Dennis Condrey, so I don't know if this is it's probably not the last Midnight Express match on TV. In fact, I probably watched one after this point, but Condrey is not there for much longer, probably about a month, because Stan Lane starts on TV April 4th, the same day as the Boston Garden Show, which he was also at that night. So he was at the taping at Techwood in Atlanta, fly up to the Boston show that night. Lane was supposedly already going to come in at some point as a heel, but they didn't quite have the spot for him yet, so they figured, okay, well, this is a good enough spot right here. Story goes that he was called, he was on the beach in Clearwater, and hey, would you like to join the Midnight Express? Yes, that would be lovely. So Windham, as I notice him, his knee pads don't match, but at least he has knee pads on. Garvin does not, but that's, again, the thing where Garvin is saying, I've been around for a long time, so I don't have to wear knee pads. Condrey, his knee pads don't match either, so now I'm scratching my head like, what's going on here? I didn't even get to really see what Bobby Eaton's were, but it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. Cornette runs over to commentary. He does this a couple of times during the match and requests that the belts be shined. I'm not sure if that was just the time, he was saying that to the timekeeper and it was overheard on Weaver or Caudill's mic or however it went. And Windham starts out with the headlock takeover because clearly he has been influenced by watching the Tim Horner match immediately before him. As Barry is running the ropes, he does that thing where he stops after a drop down and drop kicks Condry, and then has a drop kick for Eaton, then for Condry, and then back for Eaton. So it's kind of like the Ricky Rice super, not a super kick party, drop kick party. Four drop kicks by Wyndham in succession as the Midnights take a powder as we go to a commercial break. And I recall this happening on an NWA show before. I think it was Dusty Rhodes versus Tully Blanchard, the one with the money from 1987 that I covered back in episode 61. Do check that out in the archive. When they go to commercial, when they come back, they got to get this last local promo in, because this match might run all the way to the rest of the show. And as I mentioned earlier, the importance of the local promo to drive live event attendance. And who better to do that than Arn Anderson, who eventually is just going to be joined by Ric Flair, thereby ensuring that I have to play the whole thing.
Anytime you got the Four Horsemen in town, somebody's got some clout somewhere. I don't know who spent the big bucks, but somebody did to get the Horsemen at the Cumberland County Arena. So it goes like this. First of all, Ronnie Garvin, punch me all you want. Do I look like I've got a face that hadn't been punched? It's no big deal. What you do is when you get punched and you go down, you just get back up and you feed them again. You understand what I'm saying? So you're not going to knock me out. Then we're all going to take a seat. Fletcher takes out Murdoch. Luger takes out Horner. Then we sit down and we watch our cousin Ric Flair do what he does better than anybody else, Wyndham. That's defend that world heavyweight title.
Ooh, what a night it's going to be. The Four Horsemen. All of us in Fayetteville, North Carolina. All of us styling and profiling. All of us with our dukes in the air. And Barry Wyndham, you're not spoiling that for me. I don't like Fayetteville, but I'll guarantee you this. I'm going to turn it on. And in Fayetteville, you're going to be mine all night long. Woo!
I would have to imagine that these promos were recorded well ahead of time, because all of the stuff that they're talking about, with the exception of the Flair-Wyndham match, never ended up happening. Because Tully Blanchard doesn't face Dick Murdoch, because Dick Murdoch is now teaming with Ivan Koloff, and they faced Dutch Mantel and Denny Brown and defeated them on that night. Tully Blanchard ended up facing Tim Horner. Excuse me. God, I keep doing that. Arn Anderson, his match was actually against Jimmy Garvin, not Ronnie Garvin, for reasons that we'll see coming up. So I could see that part of it, where obviously he's not going to say, oh, I'm facing Jimmy Garvin, because we haven't seen the angle happen yet. But the Dick Murdoch thing had happened at least 1 week before this, and you had the thing with the Baron before that I alluded to. So I'm not going to consider this one of the all-time WCW or JCP bloopers in their TV, but it is kind of interesting and lends credence to the theory of the Dick Murdoch turn was kind of something that was done on a dime because Vladimir Petrov. I'm sorry, I can't stifle my laughter. I have a real tick on this episode with Tim Horner and Vladimir Petrov. Excuse me. Anyway, I should just get back to the match. Coming out of the ad break, the Midnights are in total control. Barry Wyndham is the one in peril as Dennis Condry has a chin lock on him, but not the reverse chin lock that you would often see where the two guys are just lying on the mat. It's like he's actually kind of locking his chin, like the literal definition of it. Apparently there were some near falls over the way, so it's not clear that Ronnie Garvin has actually ever gotten into this match as Bobby Eaton hits a back elbow, big clothesline, gets a two count, and then a sleeper hold is locked in as Johnny Weaver gets really excited, because in that part of the country it is sometimes known as the Weaver lock, but Wyndham is able to break it, but the ring has been completely cut off because this is the Midnight Express at their finest. And like I said, Garvin hasn't even gotten into the match from what we've seen, unless it happened during the commercial break where they were away. And Condry then tosses Wyndham through the ropes to the outside. And this allows Big Bubba Rogers, who is part of that entourage, don't forget about him, he does some damage out there. And the Midnights are just wearing down Barry Wyndham. And they're not like dropping bombs like they would in a squash match. As enjoyable as that is, this is more of like a systematic wear down, beat down. And maybe it's just because I have hockey on the mind, but like a defensively sound team just completely shutting down the other side and then taking advantage of whatever scoring opportunities that they are able to get. At this point in the match, I pick up on the fact that Barry Windham is wearing the trunks with the little lightning bolt on the ass, the same as Strikeforce, the same as Don Morocco did when he became The Rock. So clearly they're all shopping at the same store. I don't know who that person was, but they were making bank in the mid to late 80s. They cut to the quick Kevin Dunn memorial, quick shot of women in the crowd, because we can hear them.
He's not fucking dead.
Well, that's not for lack of trying from Jimmy Cornette, who probably has wanted to throw a fireball at him as well. By the way, in case you don't know what that drop is, that is the actor Kevin Dunn from Veep, when they kind of allude to former President Hughes as being dead. So that is a drop of actor Kevin Dunn in referring to Kevin Dunn not being dead. Anyway, I'm getting a little too clever for my own good, as a vertical suplex is blocked, but Barry is the one who ends up getting it. And it's kind of a delayed vertical, which feels a little strange considering that he's been beat down by the Midnight Express for about 8 consecutive minutes and he can hit a delayed vertical suplex. But maybe it's just on the theory of, well, he's too tired to get him all the way over, and he just kind of got stuck up there. So let's just say the crane got stuck in the up position. And he finally makes the tag, and Ronnie Garvin is in the hot Southern-style tag team wrestling tag, and got two right hands for Loverboy Dennis, got a noggin knocker, a backdrop, and then the Hands of Stone on Dennis Condrey for a third time, goes for the pin, but Bobby is in to drop an elbow on the back of Garvin's head, so that breaks up the pinfall. And this allows, we get some chaos, all four guys are in the ring, and this allows Jim Cornette, with the referee's back turned, to sneak his way in, and he's fiddling around with something, and we're about to find out what that is.
Tremendous pain. No, wait, wait, wait. Here they come to get the ball. Jim Cornette. What was that? Ronnie Garvin driving a bunch of guys in. Rock and Roll Express. Just a huge ball of flame by Cornette right in the face of Ronnie Garvin.
I have never seen...
In the face! In the face!
No!
When it comes to great fireballs in wrestling history, I can't say that I'm the preeminent historian on it, despite my love of fireballs being thrown. And after all, I probably should just watch Eddie Gilbert from about 1988 on, because he threw more than his share. Or the Sheik back in the old Detroit promotion. Sheik, probably still my number one favorite fireball throw, the random one from 95 at Halloween Havoc that was just done for the hell of it, for no particular reason at the end of the match. It's so great. But this Cornette one, it's got to be a top 3 to 5 fireball by any standard. I can't imagine that. I mean, think about it. This is something that he's brought, I don't think he's ever done before, because I think he talked about this in shoot interviews, and it's very easy to screw up. You have the Hogan Warrior thing from Halloween Havoc 98. If the damn lighter won't light, of course in the 80s they didn't have those child safety things on there, so it made it a little bit easier to get the thing lit. And by the way, if you want to buy flash paper so that you could light it on fire and throw it at your friends, it's available on Amazon.com for $14. Go to placetobenation.com/Amazon and you can help support Place to Be Nation with your purchase of flash paper so you can throw fireballs just like Jim Cornette, The Sheik, Eddie Gilbert, and all the rest. So all the baby faces run into the ring because JCP has the ethic of all the faces are friends and all the heels are friends. But to throw a little bit of a monkey wrench into that, we get Jimmy Garvin running out and Precious is alongside. Now, Jimmy Garvin, they never specifically refer to him as Ronnie Garvin's brother, probably because they kind of look nothing alike in reality. In real life, Ronnie Garvin is actually the stepfather of Jimmy Garvin. So I guess close enough, you know, however you want to play it. The two guys are brothers in storyline. I mean, think of your favorite TV show or sitcom, and you have two people who are brothers. They don't necessarily look alike. The casting agent might be paying attention to that, but they might not. But Jimmy's a heel, and he's running in, and he's helping. Now, the baby faces, they don't seem to really mind this because I think they get what's going on, that this is a family thing.
That is Jimmy Garvin. Jimmy Garvin in a
gorgeous Jimmy Garvin. What's he doing? Yes, gorgeous. Jimmy comes in. He's got a towel now around the face of Garvin. Precious is in there.
Precious is in. They're trying. Jimmy Garvin trying to lead Ronnie Garvin out. Precious showing in the way. Let's see if they go
it's,
down.
It's
down
gorgeous. Down. Jimmy Garvin in.
Precious right behind him. They're leading him down the aisle. Looks like toward the dressing room. Bob, cameraman with him. Maybe we can stay with it. There's the Rock and Roll Express. Ronnie Garvin with a face full of fire there. Jimmy Garvin in.
Not exactly the most eloquent call by Johnny Weaver. I mean, what a shock. I mean, even if Jim Ross, who at the time was criticized for being way too overexcited on stuff, you know, they put the flag on the cowboy from 86. That's also in the archive. Check that out, episode 21 of Greetings from Allentown. Jim Ross, you could count on to put it over correctly. He would get excited, but he would strike the right tone. Although I think Gordon Solie, for the time period, would have been the perfect announcer for this. But apparently he's down in Florida, I think. He might be working in Continental at this point. But, you know, he's familiar to fans of the Crockett promotion because he had called Starcades earlier on in the decade. So Jimmy is in. They get a towel on Ronnie, and they get him back to the locker room. And obviously, he can't see, so they're just kind of guiding him back there.
Trying to get Ronnie to some help, some attention. My goodness, Bob, a ball of fire right in his face.
And it caught him right full in the face. Complete surprise. He turned around, and there was Cornette. No way he had any idea something like that
he's
was
collapsed.
Coming.
Look, he's collapsed on the floor in the dressing room.
And look, there is still gorgeous Jimmy Garvin all over Ronnie Garvin. And he goes charging out of one. He's going to charge across the way to the other dressing room.
Oh, he busted the other
dressing room. He's got Cornette.
He's on Cornette. He's got Cornette in the middle of the floor. Jimmy Garvin on top of Cornette. They're trying to drag him off. There's bedlam in the other dressing room, Bob. Jimmy Garvin is winning. That's
Jimmy Garvin is so awesome during this, and I think he's a classic example of why it's important, if you care at all about the history of professional wrestling, to go back and rewatch and just kind of check yourself on certain guys. Because if you had asked me 4 or 5 years ago and you said gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, my first reaction would be, oh, he was that clown in the horrible version of the Freebirds in 91 and 92 WCW. But now, looking back, I see him in 1983 World Class, following along with the WorldCast podcast, also on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. And his run here in Crockett in 86, in 87. 86, he's got the feud with Wahoo that we saw a little bit of back episode 42 of Greetings from Allentown, cutting a promo on Wahoo McDaniel, which feels like a bad idea for a guy like Jimmy Garvin. But here, now he's out for revenge on behalf of his brother, who's been stricken by a fellow heel. And I actually thought of this point, you know, just from a kayfabe perspective. I guess kayfabe hat is on right now. If you turn face or heel in the middle of the show and your promotion has a face and heel locker room, how do you get your stuff out of the locker? Like, how does that actually work? Like, do you have a guy who, do they throw your stuff out? It has to be like that. So, because Jimmy Garvin turns babyface here, but all of his stuff is in the heel locker room, it's like Cornette in the Midnight's just going to throw his stuff out in the hallway. I figure that there would just be polite manners. And apologies for exposing the business for anybody out there. So now Precious and Jimmy, they got to get Ronnie to a medical facility or a hospital, as it's more commonly known outside the WWF or WWE. Now, and I'm laughing because they get him into the car, and Precious is driving, and I don't know if Jimmy gets in the passenger seat. They get Ronnie, like, I guess, laid out in the back seat, and they drive, like, probably 300 feet, and there's a roadblock in the middle of the parking lot, and Jimmy has to hop out the passenger side and move the barricade out of the way. It's like me trying to go to my mother's house when the Halloween parade is taking place, because they put the exact same barrier at the end of her street, so if I want to get down to her house and park in the driveway, I've got to get out the same way Jimmy Garvin did and move it. But so that was kind of funny to me. It, you know, just reminded me of something from my own life. This angle is so incredibly awesome, and it's not just for the fire. It's for the fact that literally everybody won as a result of this angle. For Jimmy Garvin, you get a face turn, a freshening up, an actual direction for him. Because after the feud with Wahoo ends in the middle of 86, he's feuding with Magnum TA when the accident happens in October. So when Magnum goes out, this leaves Jimmy without an opponent going forward. He has a match, I think, with Brad Armstrong at Starrcade 86. It's one of the ones that I watched as I started my Starrcade 86 watching, and I was kind of bored to tears in that one because there just didn't really seem to be any heat in the match, and they just did a time limit draw. Later here in 87, Jimmy Garvin gets to feud with Ric Flair. More on that in a second and how everybody benefited. Ronnie Garvin becomes an ultra sympathetic figure. You kind of forget about the fact that he was cross-dressing just the previous, you know, 2 weeks ago on NWA Pro as Miss Atlanta Lively. You know, it's just, I guess, silliness that people accepted at the time. Going to work back into the feud with Ric Flair. Garvin was kind of on track to maybe face Ric Flair in 86 at Starrcade prior to the Magnum TA injury. At least that's what I've heard, but once you turn Nikita, he becomes so hot that he becomes the natural challenger. And now this affords him an opportunity to team with his stepson, Jimmy Garvin. So now the two of them, you know, they can have some bonding time, and that's good because, you know, family first, unless there's a work thing. As they said in Arrested Development. Ric Flair, he benefits from this because he now gets a fresh opponent in Jimmy Garvin out of this whole deal because now he's on the other side of the ledger. We get the angle with him lusting after Precious, which leads to some of the greatest Ric Flair promos of all time, which he comes out and slaps him, and Ric is like, I like a woman who does that. So we learn that the Nature Boy is into rough trade. It's so great. I mean, and it doesn't happen if Jimmy Garvin is just kind of still the same guy that he was before. Jim Cornette benefits as well, because this elevates him now to cartoonish supervillainy, where he's literally throwing fire at guys, sneaking up on them from behind and doing it. Now, in storyline, he ends up getting suspended. And what that allowed Cornette in real life was a chance to go on his honeymoon as he had just gotten married to his then, I guess, first wife at the time. So during the suspension, he gets a little bit of time off there. The Midnights, of course, as I mentioned earlier, Condry just kind of jumps ship in the middle of the night and Stan Lane comes on board and they don't really miss a beat. But the fans also won out of this because think of all the great stuff we got just out of this angle with the fire, the Jimmy Garvin face turn, Precious, Flair, all that good stuff. And I saw on Twitter when I tweeted out that I would be doing this show this week as sort of a reminder that, oh, such a great time in Jim Crockett Promotions. And this angle is a big reason why, because of the things that it set in motion. Now, one thing on this show I'm glad they did not try to do is do another match after a fireball angle, because how the hell are you going to follow that? Now, Bob Caudle, they kind of do this like a post-game show where they're trying to fill time, like if the NHL on NBC airs from 8 to 11 on a Saturday night, but if the game ends at 10:45 by some fluke, well, they got to fill the airtime for the last 15 minutes. And like it is here, and Bob Caudle can't figure out how Jimmy figures into all of this, even though they have the same exact last name and are brothers, even if you're not pushing that angle on television. Johnny Weaver gives a stirring Churchillian address talking about the situation. Actually, I'm just kidding. But at this point, I start to notice what Weaver is wearing, and it's something that I've literally never seen before. He is wearing a white shirt with a black collar and a black tie.
I've never seen this before.
Never seen this before?
So despite the fact that Weaver does not compliment Caudle at all, he's just sort of yelling at him here. We're going to show a replay of the fireball, and I'm starting to get the suspicion that with the time that's left of this show, we're going to see this replay multiple times, and all that's going to make me think of is one of the classic SNL skits of all time, but it's from the Eddie Murphy era that they never liked to celebrate because Lorne Michaels wasn't there. I mean, Lorne didn't create Eddie Murphy, so clearly does that sound like any sort of wrestling promoter you might know not wanting to celebrate a guy that he didn't create? But anyway, the skit was the assassination of Buckwheat. So, yeah, some good old-fashioned assassination humor.
Buckwheat has been shot. Apparently it happened just moments ago as the legendary performer was leaving 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York. He had just finished making an appearance on Saturday Night Live, and as he was leaving the building, he was shot by an unknown assailant, or assailants. Details are sketchy at this point. Now, I understand that we now have a videotape of the shooting. Let's take a look.
And the bit was, they kept showing it over and over again for exaggerated comedic effect, and it was really great. So now you got to fill time because you just can't keep showing it over and over again. So who should you bring in for comment? Because all the baby faces are preoccupied. All the heels are preoccupied defending their locker room. So let's bring in David Crockett, because who better to comment on an injury to Ronnie Garvin than David Crockett, who sees him as a beloved figure. If you've ever watched the World Championship Wrestling shows from 85 to 87 on the network, with David Crockett basically having an orgasm every time Ronnie Garvin, you know, hits somebody with the hands of stone. So you got to figure he's got to be shooken up by this.
Remember what Cornette said several weeks it's been going on, that he was going to get rid of Garvin.
Right.
It looks like that's exactly what he tried there.
But nobody thought it would be anything like this, David.
I want to, if we can, I want to see Cornette, and I want to see exactly what he did how he did it. If we can, because Garvin, he's burned, and we want to see it. Cornette, so many times he said, "Ron Garvin, I'm going to get even. I'm going to put you out." If you remember that, he said, "I'm going to make you where nobody's going to recognize you." Isn't that correct?
Now let's see. I think we can look at it in slow motion here, David, and maybe
if we see it
in slow motion.
He's got something in his hand.
Yeah. And just how and what, I still don't know. But watch here, slow motion as Garvin turns around now. Let's see if we can figure out, fans, exactly what he did. David, what's he doing here?
Geez, I thought he was going to use an adverb that starts with F before he said face. Ladies and gentlemen, Buckwheat has been assassinated. Hey, I mean, you know, you got to get somebody's thoughts on this, and who better than David Crockett? But man, he is really freaking indignant, so he must have a hand in suspending Jimmy Cornette.
Jim Cornette, you're slime. I really can't say what I want to say right now about Mr. Cornette. So many times, you know, sometimes you think he's funny the way he talks, but not anymore, Mr. Cornette. What you done? You know, we chuckle about the way he looks, the way he acts, but now he is.
David, you can talk about her breaking an arm or a leg, but you're talking about a man's eyes.
That's
or
right.
Something. Watch here again now. We're going to go back to action in a ring, and here is Garvin down on the mat, and you can see what tremendous pain he's in. Wyndham got in to cover him because Wyndham didn't know what was happening at this stage.
He didn't. Nobody. See, we're all trying to find out exactly. It was so sudden, so quick. Do you see Cornette to the left there? They're standing around.
Well,
they're raising their
head.
Look, they've got the belt.
Yeah, he came over, grabbed a belt.
I was so concerned about Garvin, I didn't even notice it.
No, he went out with the belts.
Oh, yeah, I don't think I mentioned that myself. The Midnight stole the belts as a final FU for this whole thing. Oh, my God. This is so magnificent from start to finish. And that is a wrap on this show, but because this is NWA and NWA Pro from Jim Crockett Promotions, they give us closing credits. And I'll give you one guess as to what they play, angle from this show that they play over the closing credits. It's the assassination of Buckwheat. No, they show the fireball once again, I believe for the fourth time. But like I said, it's a good idea that they did not try anything else on this show to have to follow it, because it is completely impossible.
Here's the 0-1. This is going to be a tough play. Bryant, the Cubs win the World Series! Bryant makes the play! It's over! And the Cubs have finally won it all! 8-7-10!
One thing I really liked about the Cubs winning the World Series in 2016 is that they were the anti-Orioles in that they actually overused their closer during the playoffs instead of just letting him sit in the bullpen and rot. So congratulations to the Cubs on finally winning their World Series 11 years after the Chicago White Sox had already done it for the city of Chicago. So honestly, no big whoop on that one. Now, elsewhere in podcast land, before I get to the dramatic return of YouTube Comment Theater, want to give a shout out to some other podcasts out there. On the Sportscasters with Steve Bennett this week, he's got Will Leach coming up, the former editor-in-chief emeritus of Deadspin, and that was definitely the glory years for that website. But Will has done a lot of great things since leaving that website. I can't really say the same for Deadspin. On the Our Vantage Point podcast with Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, they wrap up their royal rankings for best WrestleManias, and I'm very pleased at the love that they gave WrestleMania 30. I mean, it is a retro wrestling podcast. It's in the name, but they gave love to that one even though it was in 2014, and I agree because that one is a fun watch, and it's one of the ones that I've actually gone back and rewatched out of the last 10 years. And on the wrestling podcast About Nothing, Brian Malonis and Mike Crockett discuss, and this is, I love when they do stuff like this where they discuss something that gets Brian upset. Not that I want him to be mad and ranting and raving or anything like that, but apparently in doing some travel for one of his shows, I can't remember if it was Ring of Honor or if he was tagging with the Bruiser out at an independent show in Wisconsin, because I know he did one of those recently. Brian had kind of a travel nightmare, so he goes in depth on that. I mean, that's something we can all relate to. So, and I particularly enjoy the episodes of the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing where Crockett is pushing Malonis's buttons, you know, by showing up late to Malonis's own indie show, Astromania, stuff like that. I get the feeling like next year when Malonis does that show again, Astromania 2, they're going to have like a special different kind of Crockett Cup named after Mike Crockett. It'll be given to the guy with the highest ratio of most slices of pizza eaten backstage versus number of minutes actually being at the show. Now that I've used up all my Mike Crockett jokes for this week, I do want to inform you that the Adams Division podcast will be making its dramatic return this weekend, early next week, somewhere in that neighborhood. And it'll be non-wrestling in nature, as we had the idea to do, Steve Bennett and I, a podcast about our 10 favorite sports teams of all time. And I'm going to try and be non-provincial about it. And these are single-season sports teams, so this could literally be anything. Could the 1997 Boston University Football Terriers make the list? Highly unlikely. I was also on the Row 1 Seat 1 podcast on the the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, hosted by Ben Zanny. He had me on at the beginning of his music episode to talk about the Boston Bruins appearing in the Stanley Cup Finals. For those of you who don't know, Ben worked at technically for TD Garden at one time in doing group sales for the Boston Bruins, amongst other events that would be held there, and it was during a real down period for the team, so a very challenging job for him all those many years ago. But without any further ado and delay, it is time for the dramatic return of YouTube Comment Theater. It's been far too long since I've done one of these, but I haven't done many videos from YouTube recently. As always, these are actual YouTube comments left by, presumably, actual users. We'll start with Richard Swartz. This is when wrestling was at its greatest, in my opinion. The Crocketts did it good. No, they did it well. They knew how to make storylines look real. Thanks for uploading this. It brings back memories of my teen years. Yes. They know how to make it look real by having a guy throw a freaking fireball at somebody else. Not to say that I didn't love it and all, but... Oh. Roderick King says, Dolby Surround Sound, where available? WCW Pro Wrestling. Well, they're not quite WCW at this point. That's just the name of the Saturday show. But they would, you know, maybe show Dolby Surround. The little graphic that would show up on the screen. Never quite understood all that went into that as a kid, because I really wasn't into sound and how that, you know, how you could improve your sound quality in theater, you know, sound and all that. E-Man XXW says, the Cornette Fireball Jimmy Garvin face turn angle is one of the best and most underrated angles in wrestling history. I remember seeing this as a kid and getting totally caught up in it. I actually went to a house show in Philly not long after this episode aired, and Jimmy Garvin, who substituted for Ronnie as Wahoo's partner versus the Midnights, got an insane pop that night. And yes, Ronnie, when he's out for a little while, Jimmy was actually going to substitute in. Leo Getz says, this is a long way to go just to have gorgeous Jimmy Garvin turn face. That was basically the gist of it, as Jimmy Garvin was a heel up to this point, as the announcers oversold the fact that no one could understand the actions of Jimmy Garvin. Then in the following couple of weeks, Jimmy would go off in interviews talking about my brother, Ronnie, and you don't mess with my family, Cornette. Still a great era of the old NWA. Well, you gotta leave something for the future for him to do in promos, so I guess from that perspective it makes sense to not immediately drive home the, hey, that's his brother, with Caudle and Weaver on commentary. Aggressive Attitude Era says, can you imagine if Jim Ross called this match? Yeah, Jim Ross in 1987 would have gone way over the top with this, which is why I think the best person at that time to call that angle would have been Gordon Solie, although I kind of would like to hear what Tony Schiavone, how he would have called it. Brad Kinder says, the Dick Murdoch heel turn was one of the more underrated ones in JCP NWA. Great stuff. So you got two underrated turns here. You got the Dick Murdoch heel turn that took place just before this, and then you got Jimmy Garvin turning face. David Fulham says, the angle that launched a million death threats against Cornette. Well, you know, that was pretty much par for the course at the time. I mean, that stuff would go on all the way up through Smoky Mountain Wrestling. Ray N. Deer says, Dr. Tom Miller was one of the best ring announcers in the business. Yeah, he was pretty damn good. Whenever I'd hear him on these Crockett shows back in the day, I also associate Dr. Tom Miller with the beginning of the podcast where the big boys play, because they would play the audio of him saying, ladies and gentlemen, our next event of the evening is a one-fall match with a 60-minute time limit. And finally, well, actually, we got two more. Satchel McQueen Video says, the Mokies were such a threat to the NWA tag titles. The grace and finesse they had in the ring before the bell rang was legendary. Hey, you lay off the Mokies, okay? They had a good thing going for a few months in 87. And finally, Storm says, and I don't think this is Lance, but who knows, Weaver is the most inarticulate person I've ever heard in an announcer's role. He could barely talk. Now think of all the announcers through wrestling history. Your Saldis, your Moscas. Not that I'm ever going to say anything bad about Angelo Mosca. Your Jack Reynolds. All the guys through the years. Is Johnny Weaver the worst one out of all of them? Probably not. There has to be somebody worse, probably from like a territory that I haven't covered yet, that I haven't quite gotten to. So if you could speak up and let me know of any particularly awful color commentators from a smaller territory that did an episode of Weekly TV, I would love to hear anything that would be worse than Johnny Weaver. And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. Still deciding on a show for next week between a world-class show that I've come across from 1984, a WWF show from 1980 that I alluded to last week with a bizarre Bob Backlund exhibition match, but I've also seen a Sunday Night Heat from the year 2000, so that would check off a year that I have yet to cover on the show, so it would basically get me from 79 up through 2001. I also got to get 1978 at some point in there. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod, where I'll probably reveal what it is next Tuesday, the show that I'm working on, or maybe in advance of that. I mean, I do like to tweet out what I've been watching, and hopefully I'll have time for it over this upcoming Memorial Day weekend. Thank you so much for listening, and be sure to give Greetings from Allentown a 5-star review on iTunes/Apple Music, whatever the hell it is called, and 5 stars wherever podcasts are reviewed. I always like when they say that for like books. It's always available at your fine bookstore, fine local bookstore. Like, yeah, remember bookstores? Yeah, I worked in them for about 3 years. So don't want to get too far off track. Gotta wrap this thing up and do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Jim Cornette, you're slime.